This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 11th of November, 2009, and joining me on the line once again is Daniel Estulin, an investigative journalist who has been reporting on the goings-on of the secretive Bilderberg Group for two decades. His best-selling book is The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, and he can be found at DanielEstulin.com. Mr. Estulin, thank you for taking the time to talk with me again today.
It's actually great to be on your show. It's actually the only show I'll be doing because, as I said to you before, we have the dearest of deadlines about what my latest book called The Shadow Masters due out in the United States and Canada in less than a month. So yes, again, thank you for having me on your show.
All right. Well, it's an honor to have you. And as I'm sure many of my listeners are aware by now, you put out a press release last week about the G20 finance ministers meeting in St. Andrews, Scotland, which took place last week. And that press release said that, quote, the G20 would be discussing how to bring down the present world financial system through dumping the U.S. dollar. So you have the floor. Give us the latest intelligence of what actually transpired at the meeting.
Thank you. G20 has come and gone. Much has been written about it. Very little of substance. There was a lot of she said, he said, they said, we said kind of stuff. But nobody really knows what exactly they discussed, what transpired, and what was the mindset of the people involved, other than the official press release and a few interviews. Almost no one, that is. Security was unprecedented this year, even by Bilderberg standards. There were, at any one time, over 500 agents guarding the installations. They were divided into three groups. The external layer was covered by the regular police force. Then there was the second layer, closer liaising with the police force outside and the security apparatus inside, which was covered by the Police Scottish Centre. However, the bulk of the assignment, the heavy-duty stuff, was done by a private security company called G4S, operating in over 100 countries and employing over 500,000 people. And with all this firepower, our people still were able to infiltrate the G20 meeting, as we have done with every Bilderberger meeting over the past almost 20 years. And not only were we able to get the latest lowdown of what these people talked about, but our people were able to get their hands on official and not so official documents, some of them written in the hands of the attendees, which people can see at www.bilderbergbook.com. And again, a very, very interesting meeting. Lots was discussed. What most people, again, who read mainstream press don't realize is that almost everyone at the meeting belonged to one or another secret society or a powerful private organization who have shown very little propensity for saving the world and helping the poor, such as, for example, Germany's finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble, who's a member of Bilderberg, U.S. Treasury Secretary Geithner, as well as Bernanke and Zolik of the World Bank. They're also full-time Bilderberg members. Britain's own Alistair Darling, he has attended Bilderberg as well. France's finance minister Christine Lagarde, she was there. Again, she's a member of the Bilderberger set. Indonesia's finance minister, Sri Malani Indrawati, I'm sure I butchered her name. Now, she's not a Bilderberger per se, but she just happens to be on Forbes' 100 most powerful women list at number 23, considering the fact that the first two positions are occupied by the Queen of England, Elizabeth II, and number two by Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, whose Nazi father, Prince Bernard, was one of the founders of the Bilderberg Group back in 1954. Again, it gives you an idea of what clout some of these people wield. Furthermore, on the list at some of the attendees, the IMF President Dominique Strauss-Kahn and Italy's Central Bank President Mario Draghi, as well as Italian Finance Minister Giulio Tremonti, not to mention Jean-Claude Trichet of European Central Bank and Joaquin Almunia from Spain. All of these individuals are members of the Bilderberger set. As well, attending some of the trilateral commission representatives, such as finance minister from Japan, Yoshihito Noda, as well as Masaki Shirakawa, its central banker, and finally, Ali Babacan, Turkish finance minister, who has attended pretty much every Bilderberger conference in the past 7 years.
So there were definitely some heavy hitters attending this year. So tell us what they were talking about and what your intelligence says about what was on the table.
Okay, let's see. Along the usual drivel, which we have heard by now ad nauseum about the G20 plan, such as to correct the imbalance that has caused the current crisis. Number one, Britain threw its weight on Saturday behind proposals to impose a global levy on banks to fund future bailouts and called on the G20 to work towards a $100 billion deal to meet the costs of the climate change. We've heard about that. When that didn't work, another proposal was tabled, and this one is one of Bilderberger's golden oldies: tax the whalehead in the name of helping the long-suffering people of the planet. That proposal was turned down by the United States delegates after calling it, and I quote, not terribly original. On a positive note, I have to give it to the Canadian finance minister, Jim Flaherty, who actually tried his best to stand up for the people of the planet. He said that the recent, and I quote, the recent public policy of privatization, privatizing profits and socializing losses is unacceptable to taxpayers, to which someone in the room cried out, and I quote, do you think they have noticed, obviously in reference to the people? The answer to that question was a generalized laughter from most attendees in the room. Gentlemen of the G20, in case you're wondering, yes, we the great unwashed have definitely noticed. And as I said before the meeting, the American and the British delegations tried to persuade the Russians and the Chinese delegates to devalue the dollar and create a basket of currencies or another world currency to take place of the dollar. Luckily, both the Russians and the Chinese told the Americans and the British to go pound sand. They were not willing to do this. Now, again, the whole idea of the Americans and the Brits trying to persuade the Russians to destroy the dollar, there's an echo as far as George Soros is concerned. He did more than slightly lift the veil of the globalists' plans in his opinion piece published, I believe it was last Thursday, that is one day before the G20 meeting, calling for a new world architecture. Now, in his essay, he stated how international capitalism, led by the United States, has broken down and how a new multilateral system based on sounder principles must be invented through the use of the International Monetary Fund. Soros stated in the article that the dollar no longer enjoys the trust and the confidence that it once did, and the U.S. ought not to shy away from wider use of the International Monetary Fund special drawing rights, because SDRs are denominated in several national currencies. No single currency would enjoy an unfair advantage. Now, I'd like to explain again why devaluing the United States dollar is a very bad idea, if that's okay with you, James.
Please go ahead.
You know, any actual collapse of the U.S. dollar would set off an immediate global chain reaction, sending the entire planet into the collapse from which the civilization will never recover. If the U.S. dollar ceases to maintain approximate parity among the principal national economies within the world system, the collapse in value of the outstanding U.S. denominated obligations, which would plunge every part of the planet into a virtually immediate general breakdown crisis, into a prolonged new dark age from which, again, as I said, relatively small minority of the population of the world will survive at the end. Let's say it again for the intellectually challenged. If ratified, and luckily it wasn't, but again, there's always an opportunity for the G20 in the future, the G20 plan would result in a virtually certain destruction of the United States. Of course, this has been the treasonous intent of the Bilderberger Group since the group's first meeting back in 1954. And if the United States dollar plunges, the collapse of the fictitious mass of outstanding dollar-denominated internal credit brought about by either devaluation or a hyperinflation of what are nominally U.S. dollar-denominated obligations would in itself prompt the sudden collapse of the entire world physical economy into a generation-long global new dark age. And again, this plan is not new. It's been talked about for a very, very long time. And I believe it was reported on your show, I did it back in May, when the Bilderbergers were meeting just before or just after their 2009 meeting in Greece. I said that this is definitely one of the plans, the destruction of the world economy. And the Bilderbergers, back at their meeting, were debating and discussing whether to make it a very prolonged recession or short and very, very intense depression, which would destroy the world economy. And again, they're still at it.
Well, absolutely they are, but we increasingly see financiers like Soros in that editorial you're referring to talking about the shift of the global economy and the motor of the global economy from the U.S. to the so-called BRIC countries of Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And it seems they're being set, those countries are being set up to be the powerhouse of the New World Economic Order. But Bilderberg is, of course, a conference for the Atlantic powers in Europe and North America. So does this indicate there's a shift going on from the Bilderberg North Atlantic, European, and North American countries to a broader power base? Or is there the same powers basically behind the scenes puppeteering this?
It's the same powers again. Bilderberg is just one of the organizations working at this. They just happen to be one of the more private, one of the more powerful organizations because, again, what today is called the Bilderberg Group goes way, way back in history. That's about 800-year-old history to the Venetian black nobility. But, again, Bilderberg is just one of the nodes. Then you have, of course, the Trilateral Commission, which is America, Europe, and Asia all working together towards the same goal, which is why some of the more important individuals at this year's G20 meeting just happened to be from the Asian nations. But again, for the system to work and for the world to actually survive, the BRIC countries have to work very closely with the United States. Look, for example, at China. If the value of the promissory notes known as the United States dollar falls, China's situation becomes virtually hopeless with no remedy available to China from parts of the world other than the United States itself. So the question again is, why are these people doing it? I believe it's part of the wholesale intent to destroy nation-state republics. I believe I said that before on your show in May. Call it new feudalism of the 21st century. Again, the essence of feudalism is that 95% of the population lives and is treated like cattle, ill-fed, poorly educated, if at all, with low life expectancy, without hope of a better life for their children. Things are run from top by usurious oligarchy and its unelected flunkies, not responsible to any Republican constituency. And, of course, the goal of this top 5% is to enhance its own power and wealth, not to develop the nation, states, and the minds of the people. Of course, again, what's today called the Bilderberg Group or the Bilderberg Club is a top-down organization run by Synergy International. Bilderberg is not exactly the control group it used to be 40 years ago, but still it's very important because it represents the Nazi fascist world company interests and, of course, the Dutch and the British royal houses, which, of course, are the most important royal houses in the world. And the intent, long-range intent of all these people is the creation of what George Ball said back in 1968 is of the World Company Limited.
So do we have any indication who the major players will be in this world company and how the developing nations are going to be brought on board with the idea?
I think at this point we don't because, again, there's so many things happening so quickly that to a certain point you may say that their plans are obviously fairly far behind schedule because the initial idea was to create their world company by the year 2000. We're almost at the end of 2009, beginning 2010. They're much closer than we would like to be, but not close enough to, as far as from their point of view, to where they would like to be at this stage. So still a lot can be done. But again, the wholesale destruction of nation states, republics, and the creation of pan-national unions is the most important element. And again, one of the key issues not discussed, and I'm saying it on your show exclusively, is the plan of the G20 to create, that's the next step in the globalization, is the creation of the African Union.
That is some key intelligence right there. So can you flesh that out in any way? So who is this coming from, and how was it raised, and how was it debated and accepted at G20?
Well, again, I don't exactly know. It hasn't been accepted or debated enough. But we certainly have, again, at bilderbergbook.com, documents where you could see what looks like the handwriting of German finance minister. But again, until I'm 100% confident, I'm not going to say it is definitively his writing. But one of the delegates had written one of the key issues to be pushed over the next year and a half is the creation of African Union. Now, the liberalization of Africa's market is, again, as I said, is the key issue at this meeting. If anyone is wondering if this is just another conspiracy, again, please go to the webpage I just mentioned and see for yourself. The phrase that these people are using is, quote-unquote, take out borders. Now, the birth of regional blocks is the intermediary step in the Bilderberg-led globalist creation of multi-state unions modeled after the European Union, with governing agencies in each bloc gradually gaining powers that supersede the authority of the governments of the individual member nations. Now, again, everyone talks about the European Union, but actually there are quite a few of these blocs already working and acting as blocs, such as, for example, ASEAN bloc, which is the Association of Southern Asian Nations, 10 member states, including Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, and Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Brunei. Then you have the APAC, not OPEC, but APAC, which is a 21 member states of the Asian Pacific Economic Group, including Australia, Canada, Chile, Japan, etc. Then you have the Economic Community of West African States called the ECOWAS, 15 members such as Nigeria, Niger, Ghana. Then you have, of course, the Mercosur in South America. Then you have the SAR, S-A-A-R-C, SARC, which are the 7 member states, including India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. And, of course, you have the Southern African Development Community, which is 14 member states, including South Africa, Angola, Zimbabwe, and a few others. Again, the creation of the borderless African continent will be spearheaded by the IMF. That's one of the things discussed at G20, with substantial help from the World Bank. A lot of the papers we have in our possession, which we stole from the meeting, is IMF's Article of Agreement, which states, and again, it's highlighted in yellow. I didn't highlight it, or we didn't highlight it. It was highlighted by one of the attendees. It states, Article 1, to give confidence to members by making the general resources of the fund temporarily available to them under adequate safeguards. Well, anybody who knows, James, about IMF obviously realizes that working with these people is bad news for business.
Right, so it sounds very much like the way the New World Order has always operated, by using their strong-arm international bodies to force governments into positions that are untenable for their own national sovereignty.
Exactly. You know, it's widely but mistakenly believed that the purpose of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, of which the United States, by the way, is the principal donor and the only nation with a veto power, is to encourage development and relieve poverty in the third world. But in practice, as you well know, these organizations have added to the impoverishment and destitute of millions of people through the loan scheme called the Structural Adjustment Program that have succeeded in adding to the country's burden of debt, interest, stagnation, and, of course, instability. The obvious reason of the structural adjustment loans from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund is that the money lent to the destitute nations are used to make immediate interest payments to Western banking institutions. Now, these SAPs involve the liberalization of African economies, which means that foreign companies are encouraged to take over designated sectors of the economy. These destitute countries of the third world have very little choice but to comply with the painful measures demanded by the bank, as the measures were, again, according to the information from the G20 meeting, essential for sustaining growth and economic stability. And, of course, additionally, nations are blackmailed into signing these secret agreements, which commit them to sell off key national assets and to take devastating economic steps in order to become eligible for a handout. Basically, that's how it works. And, of course, none of this works in favor of the nations. And, obviously, it works in favor of the European powerhouses and Bilderberger-led organizations.
So drawing on all the intelligence that you're getting at the moment, how do you see this playing out and being implemented in the short term? And what do you think will be some of the key meetings or conferences coming up in the near future?
Well, again, you know, as far as the meetings and the conferences, the way these people work is there's no head. Nobody tells anybody what to do. There's no such a thing as a guy who is really, really bad and he tells everyone what they must do. You have, at the beginning of January, you have the Davos meeting, then a month and a half later you have the Trilateral Commission regional meetings, then you have in May, June, Bilderbergers meet, in September the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank meets, then in October, November, December you have the Trilateral Regional meetings, the Americas and Europe and then Asia, and of course in between there you have the G20 meetings, you have the Council on Foreign Relations meetings, trimestral meetings, but nobody's leading the charge. Nobody's telling anyone what to do. But all of these people working together, and what's decided at one meeting before long is passed on to national, regional, local, and international governments and organizations, as well as European Union, who suddenly becomes, you know, part of the political campaign, be it national elections or European parliamentary elections. And before you know it, it now becomes law and policy, as they've done way, way back in 1992 when they talked for the first time about the creation of the European Rapid Reaction Force. and actually the Bilderberg meeting in 2006 in Canada, showed like literally a day after they finished the meeting, it was on the front page of the Toronto Star, which is a Bilderberger-held newspaper. They were talking about the United Nations has accepted and the European Union has accepted the need for a world army. So that's basically how it works. It's that nobody really tells anybody what to do. They have lots of opportunities. And, of course, the next G20 meeting is going to be held in Copenhagen. Apparently, the key issue is going to be climate change, which is all a nonsense. The key issue is going to be, again, working out the details and the finer points of how the African Union is going to be put together. Now, another key, very interesting issue, I'm just looking through some of my notes, is that completely under the radar is what I believe to be an event of utmost importance. Two groups were prominently represented at the G20 meeting, Oxfam and Human Rights Watch. That's George Soros' outfit, the same man who wanted to destroy the United States dollar, destroy the United States as a nation, and create his pan-world empire. That's Human Rights Watch. Now, what do ONGs have to do with G20? Very little, until you understand that how ONGs work hand in glove with international corporations and governments to pave the way for one world order.
Right. Well, can you flesh that out a little bit? How sure, does it work hand in glove?
Sure, absolutely. Oxfam made a presentation at the conference appealing to the wealthy nations to donate, the conference I'm obviously referring to, the G20, appealing to the wealthy nations to donate funds for the reconstruction of Africa. And they cited as an example the case of Operation Lifeline Sudan. Now, very, very briefly, or Operation Lifeline Sudan was a vast multi-billion dollar international humanitarian operation coordinating 35 major United Nations and foreign governments, from UNICEF to World Health Organizations to USAID, non-government organizations such as Oxfam, CARE, World Vision, as well as religious relief and donor organizations ostensibly designed to serve the humanitarian needs of Sudan's disaffected victims of war. Now, more than a gigantic relief operation, OLS established a major foothold throughout large swaths of southern Sudan with an endless number of relief agencies, all competing for a piece of $1 billion a year handout, along with thousands upon thousands of humanitarian foot soldiers receiving lucrative salaries. That's one part of it. Furthermore, most of these Western relief operations are almost all Anglo-American and European entities or their leading economic partners, Australia, Canada, Denmark, European Commission, France, Germany, United UK Department of International Development, and of course USAID. While OLS may be a humanitarian operation, it is also a United Nations-backed military operation with massive infrastructure projects from Nairobi in Kenya into South Sudan. Also, don't forget that without humanitarian assistance, there will be no room for undercover intelligence network operations as a part of Western imperatives of geopolitical control. And, of course, the distribution of humanitarian aid is more often than not accompanied by the NGOs working directly for the U.S. agencies through doublespeak programs euphemistically described as beneficial to Africa and African people. And these programs hide the true agenda, which passes through total economic and military domination of Africa, primarily to secure and plunder their natural resources.
Well, absolutely. And not only in terms of humanitarian aid, which of course is used as an extension of imperialist power, but also we've seen Soros's Open Society Institute used to create revolutions in country after country in Eastern Europe, for example. So we've certainly seen the way NGOs can be wielded as an instrument of the financial oligarch's power. I have millions of things that I could ask or talk about, but I'll open the floor up to you to any other points you want to make or any intelligence that you're getting at the moment.
Well, there is a point, and I think it's a very crucial element, although it was not discussed at G20, but because, again, I know how these people work, and I know their long-standing agenda of population reduction, which to a lot of people who are not initiated enough into the sphere of conspiracies may sound like something absolutely outrageous. But again, another side of the African Union, unsaid and hidden from the public, is the whole idea of population reduction. Now, how are they going to do this? African states, unable to compete with Western multinationals, have been forced to withdraw from the health sector as part of a free market economy. Now, this has put African children at the mercy of unscrupulous international organizations as well as pharmaceutical transnational companies, who are thus at liberty to use them as guinea pigs for testing various drugs and vaccines. And this is where aid agencies come in, along with the United States Christian fundamentalist Bible stompers, who have been covertly running Africa over the past several decades. Its banner is family planning, which, when you turn it on its head, you understand the real implications of what it means. Now, these family planning policies are vigorously and consistently advocated by major bilateral donors, such as the United States government through its surrogate, the United States Aid, and multilateral agencies, most notably the International Planned Parenthood Federation and the UN Fund for Population Activities, as well as the World Bank in Africa. It may surprise many, many people, but the World Bank, since the 1960s, has been the leading funding entity of the population control, with annual spending skyrocketing from $27 million back in 1969 to over $9 billion today. And, of course, more significantly, population control policies have now become a key condition required for the disbursement of structural adjustment loans by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The overriding imperative of these internationally generated programs is, again, to reduce population growth as fast and cost-effectively as possible. In much of Africa, where AIDS threatens tragic human and demographic consequences, the present emphasis on population control and defunding of health systems amount to literally indirect triage. Now, one of the specific ways in which population growth is seen as a potential threat to American strategic interests and, of course, Bilderberger strategic interests is its impact on the availability of minerals. Now, if you turn this theory around upside down at its head, if the majority of people who died, that is, were African and thus unskilled, and resources were not taken from savings to fund provisions of care, then in pure economic terms, the survivors could be better off and per capita income could rise. I asked one of the former U.S. aid representatives who spent over a decade in sub-Saharan Africa if I was on the right track. His response was short and very chilling. He said, "You're dead on target." And now Oxfam made a presentation, as I said before, again appealing to the wealthy nations to donate money for the reconstruction of Africa. When you put all of these elements together, now we understand why these people need to have their major toehold in Africa and what exactly they're planning to do over the next several years with the African population.
That's absolutely right, and that touches on so many fundamental points. But as you say, this is a long-term plan that's been unfolding for decades, and people really have to start researching into that agenda and looking at things like National Security Memorandum 200, penned by Henry Kissinger back in the 1970s, that said specifically that in the future, population reduction strategies would have to be implemented as a condition for aid to go to these countries. So this is, again, a long, long unfolding plan that's been going on. And people need to start looking into that. And I'd love to continue talking about that with you, but I know you're in a bit of a rush here, working to deadlines. Tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you're working on and what we can expect from you in the future.
Well, the key book coming out right now in less than a month in the United States is called The Shadow Masters. It will be brought out by Triday, the same company that publishing company that brought out my international bestseller, True Story, The Bilderberg Group. One of the key elements in this book is dealing with Viktor Bout, the alleged Russian gunrunner, who is sitting in a Bangkok prison called Klong Prem. They call it the Bangkok Hilton because it's probably the worst prison in all of Southeast Asia. The United States and the Russian government are fighting for the Americans trying to extradite Bout, and the Russians trying to bring this man back to Russia in one piece. And it's a really interesting story because, again, behind this tug of war between the two superpowers, you're looking at much wider and greater geopolitical interests, and that's what the book deals with. It explains how the battle that we're looking at right now literally is the future of humanity depends on whether Russia as a nation can survive or can or will be destroyed, because as long as, and Americans have seen this, especially last year after the Russia-Georgia conflict, that the only nation on earth who can stand up and do to them what can be done to it And militarily, other Russians, the Chinese really don't stand a chance. Militarily, they may have 1.3 billion people, but they are very, very inferior militarily to the Americans. Russians, in some areas, are far superior to the Americans. So they understand that before you can destroy Russia militarily, they must be destroyed in many other ways. One of the ways they've obviously tried to destroy Russia back in the 1990s was through Yeltsin and Gorbachev. They failed. Now they're back at it again. This operation has a name, a code name is Barbarossa 3. It was actually a code name designed and devised by Zbigniew Brzezinski a few years back. So this is what the book deals with. It's called The Shadow Masters, and it's coming out in less than a month in the United States.
That's absolutely fascinating, because we know that Brzezinski has been a key element of Obama's foreign policy and developing and shaping that. So that's key information about one of the key players. All right. How about some of the other projects you're working on? I understand there's also a movie coming out based on your Bilderberg book.
That's right. That's going to be out in 2011, at the end of 2011. We are weeks away from working on the script for the film itself. It was bought by a company in California. The producer is the same producer who produced Terminator 4, Terminator Salvation, I believe it was called. So these people obviously are in a financially advantageous position to put this film out independently. They made it very, very clear that they're not taking positions as whether this is right or wrong. They're just making a Hollywood film, and I'm, needless to say, very happy about that. Not because I sold out, but because I'll definitely be able to use the money I make from the film to further some of the projects I'm working on, because, as you know, to actually keep an army of people working and helping you out around the world, as I said, I'm the only person in the world who infiltrated G20 from Thailand. We're talking about 500 security guards working 24 hours a day to prevent people from infiltrating. We've infiltrated them without any problems whatsoever, and we've gotten key documents, and we've posted them on Bilderbergbook.com. So again, I'll be able to use some of the monies from the film to buy the financial independence I need to be able to research some of the key projects I have in mind in the near future.
Excellent. Well, we're looking forward to hearing about all your upcoming projects. And is Bilderbergbook.com the best place to go for that info then?
They're posted on Bilderbergbook.com, all these documents. There's 19 pages. We have additional pages. We're reviewing the first before we put them up. Hopefully we'll have them up in the next week or so. But some of these pages, again, they're very, very revealing, because some of them are typed documents, draft versions of the official policy statements of the G20 ministers. But some of the other documents are documents written by the individual members who are participating in conferences, who are taking down what other participants were saying. Their names are there. What each person said is there. So it's very, very revealing how some of these ideas very, very shortly will start making its way into the mainstream publications, such as New York Times, The Washington Post, Le Monde, etc.
It absolutely is. So I certainly hope my listeners are going to go to Bilderbergbook.com and get those documents and start pouring through them and noting how things are going to start shaping up.
Spread them far and wide. We need as many. There are no exclusive rights to this. We're doing this together. We need many people to understand that we are making a stand, that we're actually fighting for is not democracy, but liberty. And until we actually defeat these people, all of us, the entire planet is in danger. And you start with degenerates such as George Soros and company and their plan for the destruction of the United States economy. And as I said before, if America goes, we all go. And I don't think that's what we want. And luckily, the Russians and the Chinese delegates have basically said no. And the Chinese premier on Sunday, I believe, or Monday, several days ago, came out and used the Wall Street Journal, I think it was, to make a very public statement calling on the United States for fiscal responsibility and to pull the dollar up. And I have a phrase somewhere here. Let's see if I can find it amongst all my papers. No, I probably won't be able to. I will as soon as I have. There it is. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao on Sunday, he said, and I quote, exhorted the United States to keep its deficit in control to stabilize the United States dollar exchange rate. Again, another clear and very public sign that the Chinese were anything but suicidal in their plans to not destroy the United States dollar.
All right, very interesting, and this intelligence is key, so it's absolutely up to everyone out there listening right now to help spread it far and wide so we can head them off at the pass and take over their agenda before they get around to implementing it. All right, Daniel Estrelin, it's a pleasure talking to you as always, and take care, and please keep us informed about any work that you're coming up with in the future.
Thank you very much. Great talking to you.